This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books, publishing, and authors. I'm David Wilk, I'm your host, and I'm talking to Jack David from ECW Press in Toronto, Canada. I've known Jack a long time, and ECW has now been around for 50 full years of publishing. It's nice to have you here, Jack. How are you?
Good. Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, this is a series of kind of oral histories, if you will, about publishing, independent publishing. I've kind of felt that for the last maybe 50 years, it's been a pretty active time with a lot of new people coming in, you know, lots of change in publishing, you know, which used to be kind of centered on the larger publishers. And I think now is completely different. But like a lot of publishers, I think you started kind of more or less accidentally. I know you've told the origin story of ECW Press in many different contexts to many different people, but this audience may not know who you are and what you've done. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the beginning of ECW when you were a graduate student in Toronto.
Also, I've told this story in many different ways. So this will be version 74.
Maybe. And each one is different, right? Little Rashomon.
Always different. I'm like Dylan on the stage. I don't want to do the same story over and over again.
I think that's good. Yeah. And it also is, in, I think, memory is really confusing. And when sometimes the stories are the ones we want to remember, not the ones that actually happened. So we know, you know, whatever you tell us, we'll put into the context of its memories.
We had a 50th anniversary party a couple of weeks ago, and I exiled myself from the process, figuring that the younger people could figure out what to do. But they gave me 10 minutes at the start to make a talk. So I appreciated that. So what I did was I ran through in 10 minutes the entire history of ECW.
It was
we
like, could
Shakespeare,
do
it like Shakespeare in a half hour, that play.
Right, right.
So a couple of things I discovered, though. One was I really did have some kind of publishing urge or gene from an early age. And when I was in 1967, when Expo 67 was in Montreal, and I was in London, Ontario, a friend and I decided that we should go to Expo, but how are we going to get there? And we didn't have any money. Blah, blah, blah. So we got a job at a camp north of Montreal, about 30 miles north of Montreal. And at that camp, Wooden Acres, I got the idea to start a camp newspaper. And I did. Printed it on a Gestetner.
Yep.
The title of the camp newspaper was, wait for it, Camp. And we had, and I just found it last night. I found the paper. Gestetner, sloppy typos all over the place. But it had an editorial about the camp director and why he was doing such a lousy job. And so we never got to use the Gestetner machine again. It was one issue only. But it had a literary insert. And then another camp I was at a couple years later, I did the same thing. I started another newspaper. So what was that about? Why did I want to start a stupid newspaper at camp?
Yep.
It wasn't for the kids. It was for me.
Right.
And from friends of mine. And
that's then that urge to tell stories.
And at that last camp that I was at, two other guys and I started to think about doing a musical, comedy, whatever, takeoff, parody. And the two guys, one guy was named Ron Moldowski and the other guy was named Ricky Moranis.
Yeah.
Because Ricky was a CIT at the time and I was a counselor. And so I've got that play.
Right.
Ricky was 16, I think, maybe 15.
Did you ever perform this musical?
Oh, yeah. It was a big hit at camp. Everybody thought we were just fooling around, but boy, it was great. And we had a lot of good voices, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so those are the examples of this pre-graduate student, let's start a magazine.
Yep.
That seems to have been there. So yep. We started, I made a call and a bunch of people showed up. We had a meeting. I said, we have $400. Let's start a magazine. And people wanted to start a literary magazine. They wanted this and this. And I said, no, let's do a critical journal. So this winnowed the crowd down.
but these were graduate students in a field, right? What was the field?
Canadian literature.
Right.
So at York University. So part of it was that the idea was, let's come up with a title. And the initial title was Roots/Roots. R-O-O-R-O-U. And a subtitle was Essays on Canadian Writing, because that's what it was about. And eventually everybody figured, or at least I figured, this was a stupid title of Roots Roots that I would have to live with, although I didn't know for 50 years. So we stuck with the subtitle, and that's what the journal became.
Right.
And out of the journal, the ECW came, the Essays on Canadian Writing. And out of that, the publishing business began, the journal first, and then books about 3 or 4 years later. And at the same time, my partner at that time, Robert Lecker, who was only my partner for 28 years, that, I'm a easygoing kind of guy. So we decided to do books, and we did textbooks for other people, figuring we would make a lot of money. Holt Reinhardt, we did. Harper, we did. A couple others, big books.
These were, when you say did for other publishers, do you mean that you did all the work to, and then
we proposed the idea.
Right.
We got them to give us an advance, which covered our costs.
Right.
We produced it, we typeset it, and we gave it to them and said, print it and sell it. Because right. didn't have any reps in the field, obviously.
Right. So, but were their names on the book? So it was... Was
absolutely,
it
edited by.
Yeah.
And there was a squabble, it's a dispute between Robert and me. He go first, I go first, he go first. So we flipped the coin. And if you see all the books that we've done, which between Robert and me probably are 40 books, the names alternate.
A fair resolution to credit conflict.
So that's how we got started. The very first issue of the journal, we published a bibliography about B.P. Nichol, who was I was a big fan of, and he was
me too.
He was still young.
This was before the Four Horsemen, right?
It was after it was. They had started already.
Okay.
They started in maybe 69, 70, somewhere around there. Anyway. The next issue, we published a bibliography of John Newlove that Robert had created. So both of us loved to do bibliographies. And that was the first book that we did, which was a series of bibliographies on Canadian writing.
And the market for those books, was it primarily libraries at that point?
Primarily and only. what we did do was, because Robert was editing a series for Gale Research, not Gale Research, Gale.
Mm-hmm.
Those individual monographs on writers. But Gale was also connected with G.K. Hall. I'm not sure what the ownership was. And Robert went to G.K. Hall when he was visiting Gale and said, how would you guys like to distribute this annotated bibliography of Canada's major authors to the U.S.? And they said, well, that's a pretty good idea. So they became the distributor. And that was they bought 500 copies. And we thought, okay, this is it. We're in the money now. And we ended up doing 8 volumes of that series.
That's good. I mean, it's a good way to start. I mean, probably providing you with the illusion that the book business would be a nice, steady.
The illusion has not ended.
So that was mid-70s sometime?
Yeah.
Mid-70s.
Mid-late 70s.
And then what happened after that?
Robert, at a conference for the journal, ran into a guy named John Metcalf, who was also at the conference. He was a Canadian writer, iconoclastic, They got talking. He was unhappy with his current publisher, a company called Oberon. They had an awful contract. They were the ones who published the W.P. Kinsella book about Shoeless Joe.
Yeah, I remember them. Yeah.
He, Kinsella, never made any money out of the movie rights.
Right.
The contract was so awful. Anyway, so Metcalf decided that he wanted a new publisher, and we were a publisher. Well, we had published a couple of bibliographies in a journal. But he said, yeah, if you publish me, you also get Hugh Hood and Leon Rook. And Robert said, boy, let's do this. So yeah. Knowing nothing, literally knowing nothing, we went into the trade business.
With three authors who are primarily known in Canada.
Yes.
Not very well known in America.
No.
Right. So you kind of identify immediately. Well, I mean, it sort of follows. You're then at that point identified as a Canadian literary publisher.
Correct.
Oh, and there were several others around that time.
Yes. There was a burgeoning in the 70s of Canadian publishers.
Exactly. Which kept growing into the 80s. And
yes.
So did you feel that sense of community with other, you know, as being part of a community of publishers?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And always have. And I've always been involved in the organizations, Literary Press Group, Association of Canadian Publishers, Ontario Book Publishers Association, president of the Ontario Group, chair of the LPG three times, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because that was my family. That was I taught for a long time. I had other jobs, but I never felt as compatible with a group of people as I had with other publishers.
Yeah. I used to visit Canada in the 80s, early 80s, and met a lot of your, colleagues and friends. And I agree, it was an amazing community. And the border between the publishers and the authors was much less visible. You know, I think in America, I think Canada is more like England in this way because it's a smaller community. And so there's a fluidity between the writing community and the publishing community. Often authors ended up as publishers they were all friends, colleagues in a way that, you know, in some instances is unusual, I think.
It still happens. There are some new companies. Not many who have started, but the ones who have, it's a writer or a bookseller or no one's in it to make money. Everybody's told at the beginning, it's going to be your money. Your life's going to be terrible. The bank's going to be on your case, blah, blah, blah. But people do it.
And it may be in Canada, it noticeably the literary publishers as a group, there's also a group of children's book publishers.
Yeah.
And they're similar. Sometimes there are crossovers, but that does seem like the literary publishers really align together pretty closely.
The children's publishers, not including Scholastic, which was the NPRH, which has a children's line, but the children's publishers, the independent Canadian children's publishers, are very tight and they go back and forth. This person worked at Kids Can, then went to Owl, and then went from Owl to Groundwood, and Groundwood went over. Da, 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 da. So they all know each other.
And I guess this is mainly for American audiences to ask about. Do you feel that there's a strong sense of geographical location as part of that within that community? In other words, that the Vancouver publishers being so far away. And the Midwestern publishers.
No, it's east west. It's not north south. Okay. And it's right across the country from Newfoundland right over to Victoria.
So in other words, the community is across the country. It doesn't break up so much by region.
No. There are publishers in every province, and part of that is because of the support from the federal government and from the local provincial government.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, Canadian support for literature is vastly better than in America on a sort of per capita basis.
Let me correct you, David, because years ago, we had a conference in Toronto, and Milkweed and Copper Canyon and some others came up. And we were talking about money, of course. How much money do you get? How much, you know, what's your budget? Blah, blah, blah. How many copies do you sell? And the deal was, we, yes, got grants from two levels of government, but we were not nonprofit. And so they then had all kinds of institutional support, which they could use. And when we compared budgets, they were very close. But the source of income, apart from sales, was two different sources.
Right. Although I think the group of publishers that you're talking about in the United States that are nonprofit is very small comparatively. Whereas, you know, there are thousands of publishers here who are not nonprofit and cannot access those sources of funding. I guess I was thinking more of governmental funding in Canada.
Governmental funding in Canada goes to literary publishers.
Right.
It doesn't go to cookbook publishers, and it doesn't go to how-to publishers and whatever.
Right, which makes sense.
It has to have cultural viability in some way.
And the idea behind that is to protect the Canadian culture from being overwhelmed by its neighbor to the south.
Correct.
And I think it's a pretty valid...
And we are overwhelmed. Despite the support, PRH and Harper and now Simon & Schuster dominate the market. And because they have all the books that they bring in from the States, they then can use that extra money and the low distribution cost to sign up big Canadian authors. And we don't get a shot at them.
Right.
We get a shot, but we can't compete.
Right. It was sort of a nod. A formal, we'll offer it to everyone, but we'll take the high offer.
They don't even do that anymore. And we're playing in a minor league system. We're not the major leagues.
Are you able to export enough to US and England and other markets?
We could be based in Tonawanda outside of Buffalo because half our sales are in the States.
And has that been true for how long, would you say?
I don't know, since that day that I came to see you and talk to you about our Katie Lang book.
Right. I remember that book. That was a big deal. It was a big deal for both of us.
Yeah.
I think Katie Lang kind of put you on the map in 1992, I think it was.
91, I think. Maybe 92. It put us in the map for having books that could sell.
Right.
Up until then, if we had a book, it would be, here's a bunch of essays about Alice Munro. Nobody knew who the fuck she was.
Well, now they do. But
Now they do. Yeah. That was how we were.
And Katie Lang sort of opened some doors for Canadian music too. I mean, she was not a one-off, but to some extent, I think in America,
I don't think the book had anything to do with her success in music.
No. I don't mean the book. I mean that Katie Lang in the music world, she crossed border and didn't matter.
No, for sure. That was the case. Yeah. She came out and she said, I don't eat meat and blah, blah. All the stuff that she did, and people went, whoa, who's this thing? What's going on here?
And she was from Red Deer, right? So,
well, she was from Alberta. Yeah. But yeah, she moved around in Alberta. She was a cowgirl.
Right. So, and of course, there is a big connection between the cowboy world of America, you know, the American West and the Canadian West. But I remember, I think what we were all thinking in 1992 was it had to be a short biography because she was so young. There wasn't
and
that
across
much.
Across the province from her, next to Alberta was Saskatchewan. And that's where Joni came from.
Right.
And then next door to Saskatchewan was Guess Hootland.
That's right. Oh, yeah. I forget. You know, you always...
Neil Young in Winnipeg.
Yeah.
There was a lot of burgeoning activity that was taking place in the 70s and 80s.
Right. Although most of them came to America.
Oh, yeah.
For
virtually everybody went to America.
Yeah. So after Katie Lang kind of improved your prospects,
it changed our mindset because it said two things. One, Robert and I had a meeting, and part of the meeting was, who is telling us we can only publish books about Canadian authors? It's our company. We started it. We can do whatever we want. Let's try doing a little biography about some other people, not just writers. And that's where KD came from. And then we said, well, why do we have to do only people who are writers or singers or what, artsy in some way? And at that point, I was watching The X-Files, and it occurred to me that we should do a book about The X-Files, because that was my larger trade instinct. But we couldn't do a book about The X-Files. I figured there was going to be some kind of legal problems, who knows what. Didn't know any about that stuff. So I focused on doing a biography of David Duchovny. Right. And that was our first real breakthrough book, not just in Canada and the States, but overseas. And we sold rights all over the place, to UK and to Japan, to Italy, all kinds of, whoa, there's a market out there.
So that allowed you to learn about the idea of rights sales around the world, not just selling books, and the efficiency of selling rights, because they send you a check. You don't have to worry about printing books and returns and all that stuff.
When we got a sale, we had an agent who worked for General Distribution, and he took on smaller clients. And when he called up and he said he's got a sale at the London Book Fair, and I said, well, that's great. And I said, how much? He said, £12,000. I said, what? £12,000? The pound was worth something back then.
Right.
And I thought, oh, this is a pretty good way to make money.
Right. So did that change the way, in what ways did that change how you thought about?
It meant that everything was possible.
Right. But did you start then commissioning books based on ideas you had?
Yes.
More than before?
Yes. That happened. And the more we did in certain areas, the more stuff came in.
Right.
So when we did our first wrestling book, it was by an American. It was no grants associated with it.
Yeah.
And it was here are some heroes, here are some villains. That was the title of the book. Who cares? Everybody said, wrestling fans don't buy books. They're illiterate. So now we're 50 or 60 books down the road and probably the biggest publisher of wrestling books in the world, because they are not illiterate. They're fans. Fans love to read about whatever they're fan of.
Right.
Last night, your buddy from the U.S. did her first concert here, and she's doing six, all sold out. At Taylor, of course. Mm-hmm. And the whole downtown is closed. I have a friend who lives in that area. He said, I can't get out. I can't get in. It's not just the people who are going to the show. It's people who are hanging on, people who are buying merch, people on the streets, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, if it was earlier, although we did do a Taylor Swift book years ago, but if at this point we can say, let's do a Taylor Swift book.
Right. So you can do basically whatever you want to do.
Yep.
And you follow the call. I mean, is it just you, or now do you other people there?
Yeah, it's five of us who acquire.
Yeah. So you're following what's the trends in culture.
Partly that, but it's mostly a model which is not that common in publishing, which is that we believe that the best books come from passionate editors, and whatever their passion is, we'll support. Assuming that the advance isn't crazy, because we don't, what do we know? We're, you know, what do I know? I know baseball. That's, you know, I don't know much. And if we do that, when we have an editorial meeting, as we will on Monday, one of our editors is going to come forward and say, I've got a really good book about glassware. And I'm going to go like, what? But here's my proposal. And here's the market. And we say, fine. Okay, you got 3 years. See what you can do.
And if it works.
Very few models in the States that follow that, apart from the single owner. But right. When you get up, the only one I've read about is Farrar Straus that does it that way, that they acquire based on the passion of the editor.
Yeah, I think of W.W. Norton as being possibly still enabling the kind of editorially driven passion.
Yes, but that's the principle.
Right. It is more limited today, I think, in publishing to publishers that are have the freedom of not having an editorial committee, let's say, or a corporate owner that requires a certain level of profit.
And that's how I got started, because a friend of mine who was an editor at General Distribution and started publishing, which was then the second largest trade company in Canada, had a book by a doctor who had a column in a bunch of newspapers. And he took it into the editorial meeting, and the publicist said, I don't think I can do anything with this guy. And the production person said, it's going to be too pricey. And the marketing person said, I don't know where these readers are, blah, blah, blah. And it comes to the publisher, who's got the final say. And he says, well, consensus of the meeting is, I don't think we should do this book. So my friend comes out of the meeting, he's steamed, and he calls me up and he says, we've got this book. The guy has pre-sold 3,000 or 4,000 copies. He's great to work with. He's in 100 newspapers across North America. He's not going to need that much money. You want to do the book? So, of course. And it doesn't end there, because a year and a half ago, in Harper, Canada, they had turned down a book about a guy named John Gibbons. He had been the manager at the Blue Jays, and right now he's a bench coach of the Mets. Yeah. He had been a catcher, then a manager, but he wasn't a manager now. And they had the editorial meeting. Jim Gifford told me the whole story. They had the editorial meeting. Of course, you've got 18 women and one guy. And when you say, well, I'd like to do a baseball book, and they say, well, I don't know, who is this guy? And well, I don't know, da, da, da. Didn't we do a baseball book before? How did it do? Oh, we sold 3,000 or 4,000. Oh, that's fine. You hear that? It's when that group consensus makes lousy decisions.
Yeah.
That's what kills it.
Yeah.
So he came. So then Jim Gifford came to us with this book by John Gibbons, and we signed him up the next day.
So has this book already come out, or is this one that you're working on?
Oh, the book came out. Yeah, we've sold about 9,000 so far.
That's pretty good. I mean, that's really good.
That's good.
No, I hear all the time from publishers who are, you know, getting lower numbers today than they had 10 years ago.
No.
9,000 is pretty good now.
Yeah, hardcover.
So I'm kind of curious about that, because baseball is one of my passions. I know a lot of baseball books. I read a lot of baseball books. And I've sort of envisioned it as more of a niche than it probably is. But what is it that drives the sale of John Gibbons' book? Because I think he is not a famous baseball player by any means.
No, he was a much loved manager. He was a down home Texas guy with a drawl, but who was very sharp. And reporters hung around and they collected all the stories. And all he did in the book was tell those stories.
So he's a good storyteller.
Great storyteller. And very willing to promote.
Right.
And when he came, so he's he lives in Texas. And when he came back up to do promotion, everybody wanted him because he told stories.
Right. And it is true. You know, the one benefit of sports books is you can tie into sports media, which is a pretty powerful media business now. still in any major sport. So
We can do it all. We can do it all in Toronto, cover Canada. Right.
So I assume this applies pretty well to hockey in Canada. You know, since you're in Canada,
the big out of the top 10 nonfiction books in today's paper, three of them are hockey books. One of them is by a second book by a guy who we published initially, and he got a huge contract from Harper. I don't know how much, but there's no way that they're going to earn it out.
You earlier referred to yourself as a kind of, you said minor leagues. There's been this sort of, I think for a long time, a lot of small publishers, I felt this way maybe 50 years ago, that one of the first books I published ended up launching a career of a writer who then got a really big contract that I could not come. I mean, it was just not even a conversation. Yep. So I kind of cast myself as a farm team.
Exactly how we see ourselves.
Yeah. And sort of that creates limitations, but it's not that you're self-limiting. It is really based on the reality of the marketplace. That the budget of let's say the Hartford Yard Goats, which is a team I know in Connecticut, you know, their budget is minuscule compared to the Yankees or Boston Red Sox or Toronto Blue Jays. And that's sort of, you know, you can operate within the boundaries that are set forth for you because of the market.
And we have occasionally bid big numbers. And there was, I don't know if you remember, Bret Hart, the Hart family in Calgary. So Bret Hart, who's a crazy man, but had a big following, had written his autobiography. We think somebody else was involved. Don't know. It was huge. It was out of control. It was, 600 pages of ramble. But Michael, my wrestling guy, figured that he could get it down to 250 and tell the story. And we knew the wrestling market far better than almost anybody else.
Yeah.
So we bid. We bid 100,000 for the book. And years later, I ran into Brad Martin, who was running PRH in Canada at the time. I think I ran him to Book Expo, someplace like that. And I said, what'd you ultimately pay for that? And he said, first of all, you had no business being involved in that book. Because you weren't going to get it. We're going to outbid you no matter what. And so 100 to us meant like, we're putting the company on the line.
Right.
I said, what'd you end up paying? He said, I don't know, 2.25, 250, something like that. Did you earn out? Probably, he said. We would have certainly earned out at 100.
Yeah. Yeah.
So occasionally we go into those contests and we get beat. We get beat every time. And we're a standard advance for us now is 5 or 10, 12 maybe, that kind of thing. But once we get up into 15 or 20, the atmosphere gets pretty thin.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of, is there ever an opportunity where you get a kind of home team discount or, you have someone with loyalty to you that will supersede?
Not if there's an agent involved, the answer is no.
Right.
If it's the author only, then we try to be as good as we can be.
Yeah.
And, one other story from today is that we have a book called Moon of the Crested Snow by a guy named Wob Rice. It's a post-apocalyptic novel, takes place in Canada. He's a Anishinaabe from sort of middle, upper northern Ontario.
Yeah.
Anyway, we did the book, didn't do much. Then it began to get word of mouth, and it took off. Immediately, when the book took off, he was approached by an agent, the nastiest agent in Canada. And she took him to PRH, and he got a huge advance. And the book that they signed up was the sequel to our book. So during last year, during the summer and into the fall, our book, their book, were sitting on the bestseller list, 7, 8, 4, 6, da da da. And their new book was beating our book, but our book was now 4.5 years old.
Right.
And we were selling a lot of copies. And eventually, our book sold more copies than theirs, just in that one period, because our book was better. Happens. So we've now sold somewhere around 140,000 copies of this book. And we sell 7,000 a year in the U.S. of this book. Anyway, the book now is like 5.5 years old. This morning, I read in the paper, it's number 10 on the Canadian fiction list. It's a great backlist book. And their book has just gone out of sight.
That's so interesting.
So that's the story. That's the success story that we can have. Find a great book, promote it, see it sell, and have a long life.
Can you tell? It sort of goes, maybe this is a corollary question. Does that create a story that you can then use with agents and authors to say, yes, you will take the big bucks, but in the end, you would be better off with a smaller publisher?
Come on, David, we can tell that story for 1,000 years.
I know.
Short-term versus long-term thinking. You know, there are some people who say, I will take the long-term.
I agree. Short-term. I agree. Find me those people.
You know,
they don't have agent after their name.
Yeah, right. That's true. And it is a kind of dynamic of agents worldwide that they have to go after the money for a variety of dynamic reasons, which are fairly obvious. While we were talking, I just realized the better corollary for comparing you to bigger publishers is, because you'll get this in baseball history, the Pacific Coast League in the 1940s, before the National League sent two teams to the West, the Pacific Coast League could actually almost compete. Not quite, you know, not really, but almost compete because they had a market to themselves. So you maybe could see yourself as the Pacific Coast League of publishing.
We're AAA.
Yeah, well, they were, but they were a really good AAA.
That's who we are.
San Francisco Seals. That's who you are.
We've talked about ways to get us out of this hole by doing something like the Japanese teams and making the big guys post when they want to buy.
I thought of that too. Yeah.
Yeah, but that doesn't go too far. And then we thought, well, what if on all the distribution income that Harper and PRH and Simon & Schuster make, they have to pay 5% to a fund to support Canadian publishing?
I think we floated that idea in America in 1980. I can tell you how far it got.
I know.
It's similar to the public lending right in England. We wanted to think about whether we could do that here because it's a form of public funding for literature that is not grant driven. It's more like a tax. And tax revenue, we understand, you know, makes sense to support, you know, farmers who can't compete with foreign providers or whatever. It's sort of almost like a tariff on the, you know, on the bigger publishers' books, but it never gets anywhere, you know, for obvious reasons.
We talk about this all the time, and everybody's got five ideas.
The only idea I can think of that actually might work would be for you to sign multiple book contracts with the books where you think there's actually a chance that there would be a sequel. Sign them to a right of first refusal or an actual multi-book deal. It's a bigger risk for you, but then it provides you
kind of... We do that with the genre books, with the mysteries and the romances in those books. But the option clause that we have, unless we sign up the book, or unless we specified that the central character has to be in that, whatever the next book is going to be.
Yep.
It means nothing.
Right. And well, because what about though a multiple book contract where you say we will publish this book and we will also publish your next book?
No, I'm saying we do that with in certain genres.
Right.
That's rolling the dice on who we think is going to actually produce another book.
Exactly.
And whether that book is going to be equal to or better than the first book that they wrote.
Which is maybe too big of a reach, you know, in many cases. Not possible.
Basically, we're fucked.
But you're fucked and successful at this point. In a modest way, I assume.
Yeah, we're in a modest way. We're profitable about 8 years out of 10. And we are combined with the kids company that we're connecting with, we're now about a $10 million company. So that's big for Canada.
Yeah, it is. I think it's big for America. It puts you in the range of being a mid major. Mid independent. Mid large independent. So you mentioned children's books as a kind of active thing. Is that recent?
Yeah. So years ago, we were talking about revenue sources. This is an ongoing conversation between David and me, and we just figured that the more revenue sources we had, the better off we were going to be. Not because of the amount, but because of the balancing off of US up, Canada down, Canada up, US down. Who knows?
Right.
Ebooks up, audiobooks down, audiobooks up, whatever.
Right.
Foreign rights up, foreign, all of that stuff. So we had to have enough ways of collecting revenue that we would be removed from that real disaster that was going to happen. And we knew it would happen somewhere. You just never know. I was at lunch yesterday with my publishing friends. We get together about every 2 months. And I was sitting next to Karen Borsma from Owl, which is a kids publisher. And she said, I'd just like to have 1 year when nothing happens. We just have a regular year where there's no Trump. There's no pandemic.
Yeah.
There's no distribution, blah, blah. And I said, of course, it's never going to happen.
Yeah.
Every year we get buffeted by something we just don't predict.
Right. So you're going to become a children's book.
In terms of Anik.
Yeah.
We're probably a year away from closing the deal, but they've moved into our office now. And
great.
David is doing a lot of their financial stuff. And we're more integrated.
Anik is a great publisher.
And they're a great publisher. And the learning about how backlist works with kids publishers is like every 5 years they got a whole new crowd.
And one thing about children's books that is observable and fairly obvious, there are always children being born. And parents need to read books to their children, and grandparents need to give books to their grandchildren. So it has that evergreen value.
Yeah.
But of course it's also difficult because you have the sort of established books that people treat as the classics, and the new books are coming in waves every year because everyone has an idea for a kid's book. And how do you get them to break into consciousness of parents? It's not the kids, it's the parents. Really hard.
How do you do that with any new book?
Yeah. I mean, that is I've spent the last 10 years repeating over and over again, publishing is easy. Marketing is really hard. And I just like the publishing part. I must admit, the marketing part is just not that fun. I mean, some people like it, but I'd be more like an editor. You know, I like the book. I want everyone to read this book, but I don't know how to get that to happen. it's really hard. So, How many books a year do you publish now?
About 45 or 50. We got up to 60 and then found it was just beyond what we could do effectively. We had to hire some more people, and then we had to hire an extra person because blah, 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 blah. So at this range, we have about 20, 22 people. Mm-hmm. And Annex got about the same number.
Yeah.
And so we're about a 40-person company now.
And is Annex publishing roughly the same number of books a year?
Yeah. Annex does fewer with way fewer words.
Yes.
They take a lot of time on 800 words. I just don't get it. The Leonard Cohen book that we just published is 160,000 words. And we took a lot of care with it, but it ain't 800 words. It's a different business, and the production is different, and the market is it's like a different business. The only thing the same is that at the end of the line there's a book. You try and sell it. But all that stuff leading up is something else.
So you mentioned earlier ebooks and audiobooks. We probably should at least touch on your ideas about both of those areas. Ebooks, you know, maybe 20 years we've had with the advent of the Kindle, essentially, and everything that followed that. I presume you have all of your books today. You publish simultaneously print and ebook. Have you gone back to your backlist and converted previously print only to ebook as well?
Yeah, we did a lot of that, depending on the numbers. And that was, whether it pays off or not, it's a gamble like anything else. But on the audiobook side, I don't take credit for what we've done. It's David. And probably 6 years ago, 7 years ago, he began traveling to New York and talking to people who were involved in producing audiobooks. And there weren't that many. And he became friendly with everybody, and he found out how to handle it and what to do, and what about if you didn't have your own studio, and what about pickups and all that shit. And then the Canadian government decided that there should be more accessible books for people in Canada. And they were thinking ebooks, but then audiobooks showed up. So they offered a grant for publishers to get their books turned into audiobooks. It was a period of about 3 years. And everybody said, well, what do we do? But we were already doing it, and we became a focus, and we set up our own little division for books from external people. And we have a lot of audio business based on this big backlist we've got. We've got, I don't know, 300 audiobooks. We deal with all the players.
So you
anyway, just to say that was David's initiative.
Right.
To set up.
This is your current partner, David Karen.
My current boss.
Yeah.
Yes, my current boss.
Did he buy you out?
Pardon?
Did he buy you out?
Yeah. Yeah. He bought me out in 2013, 14, somewhere around there.
Okay. But a succession plan, perhaps?
That was the succession plan. I met him initially because he was the director of the Literary Press Group, and I was the chair. And we went through the general distribution bankruptcy together. And after a couple of years, when Robert was very unhappy with the financial position of the company because no one was paying us, as you may remember.
Yeah.
when we had GDS go and you went, and then we went to Stewart House and they disappeared. So we were having trouble finding sources of cash. And David and I went through trying to deal with 40-ish Literary Press Group publishers who were not getting paid by General because they were bankrupt. It was a hairy time. And David was a rock. So when I bought out Robert and I brought David in, it was pretty clear that he was going to take over at some point. He's much better at numbers than I am. And he's much better. I was okay at dealing with banks, but I never looked. If I had to write a check, I never knew if it was going to go through or not. I think I was more like a, you know, a small five book a year publisher. And suddenly we were doing 25 or 30 books. And who knows, where was the money? How much did we have? I don't know. Yeah, anyway, that wasn't my strength.
Yeah, no, I understand. That changes the dynamic of running a business considerably. So I want to go just finish up on the audiobook thing. So does that mean you are self-distributing your audio? You're an audiobook publisher. You distribute them just like so you don't have to license to audio companies.
No, we do. Occasionally we do, because we'll try out the market before we take it in-house. And so we had a surprise last year when Emily, who handles our rights, had the Leonard Cohen book. And she went around to record it and da da da. And Audible came back, and Audible said, "We'd like this book." And we said, "Well, what's your offer?" And they said, $10,000 US. And we said, "Nah, it's not going to do it." Although we had never gotten 10 before for an audiobook. So we got them up to 12. And then they said, "Well, that's English. How about all the other languages? How about French?" We said, okay. So in the end, they paid $14.5 for world audio rights for this book, US. Mm-hmm. So that's like 18 or 19 Canadian. Yep. And I thought, okay, I've made my numbers on this book now.
All right. Great.
So we'll always go out there just seeing if there's somebody who sees it differently than we do.
And are you producing books in-house?
We have one person devoted to to overseeing the production. At any time, we'll have 20 or 30 books underway.
Got it. And do you use professional readers or authors or both?
There's a thing called ACTRA, which is the Association of Canadian Actors. And David used to be the director or worked there at ACTRA. And so he knows that there's all these actors out there who have great voices.
Yep.
And those are the people we hire. And we got a blanket rate, and we use studios right across the country, and we produce them and then send them out to Hoopla and send them out to all those players.
And were you also suggesting you do this for other publishers?
Of the 20 or 30 that might be underway right now, probably 15 are university presses come to us. Small literary publishers come to us for a couple of reasons. One is we're good. And the other is they know that they're going to get something for the price that they're going to pay. And we go through the process. We get three or four audio interviews with people, read these six pages, send it out. People decide, I like this one, don't like that one, try this one. I need a Scottish voice. You know, we can get that. Mm-hmm. It's a huge range of voices in Canada.
So are some of your publisher clients in America, or are they all Canadian?
All Canadian.
Cool. Well, how do you envision the future? I mean, is it like simply more of the same and, you know, every year you're going to be buffeted by something you can't predict?
Our backlist at ECW is probably 40% now of our revenue. So that gives us the kind of support that we can use. With Anik, their backlist is about 70% of their revenue. So they could go to sleep and have a good year.
Yeah.
We've always tried to explain that to banks, that if you close this down, you're never going to get your money. If you let us continue, we can fire everybody and just sell our backlist, and we can do it far better than you. You know, we go through that process.
Yeah.
And we switch banks probably every 3 or 4 years because they're all assholes, and it's just going from one asshole to another asshole.
I hope they're not listening to this.
So we're building. I'm still acquiring probably 12, 13, 14 books a year, and Michael is acquiring probably the same amount. So between the two of us, we're doing 20 or 25 books. We knew that at some point it was going to be I'm having a stroke, you know.
Right.
It's going to happen.
Yeah.
Michael's in his mid-50s, and he's got another good 10 years to run, but he's ready to start slowing down. So we've taken on new, younger editors, and we've tried to expand the range of what they do. So one of our editors, one of our acquiring editors, is in Vancouver, and she is intimate with the Vancouver scene. She's a writer herself. She's taught writing, and she knows everybody. And so we've got a whole new slew of writers that come to her that would never come to us. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to say, okay, Michael is doing wrestling and pop culture. Jack's doing whatever he's doing, whatever it is. And I'm working on a whistleblower book right now. So I like that kind of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Take it back. It's like the editorial I wrote in that newsletter I wrote at camp. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
And
it's nice to know you're the same person you were when you were 12 years old.
Yes. We're all the same people we were. So yeah, I see it pretty much going as it is. And I don't know. I can see ahead maybe 10 years, not for me necessarily, but for the company. It's about as far as I can see.
Do you have one kind of last thought about, I don't mean last for you, but for this interview, a thought about, how do you feel about the book business itself? You've always been, I sort of see you as an iconoclastic person in some sense, not a revolutionary per se, but you carved out a path that's fairly singular, I think, and you should get a lot of credit for that. But I just always wonder how you see the business from your perspective, as a, you've been doing this for 50 years, so you know something.
So last year, I got a phone call from a student at Centennial from their publishing program. And she said, Denise, who runs the program, said I should call you up because I have a question. I said, sure. She says, so what's changed in the last 50 years? So where do you start? Do you start with the fax machine? Start with the computer? Do you start with PDF? What do you do?
Yeah.
So I said, a lot of technology has changed. Pretty much all the technology has changed. Here's what hasn't changed. Great books with great writing and us finding a way to get them out to the market. And that would be my answer in 1865, probably, yeah, if I was working in London. Let's get a great book. Let's get a great author. And let's get out there and sell the shit out of it.
It's a pretty good summary of what the business is.
I don't think that's going to change. How it gets out there?
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll have a little chip in our brain, or in our glasses, or who knows what.
Yep.
But long form writing in fiction and nonfiction, there's a space for that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a good way for us to end the conversation, because I think it gives us some optimistic, some hope. And I appreciate because I think a lot of us, either in publishing or around it, and who are writers, there's always a sense of doom. Things are terrible. It's not going to get better. And I think it's really helpful to realize that in publishing, things have never been easy. And the process is pretty much the same, but the methods are different. Strategy may change, but it's sort of like the story doesn't. The overall story doesn't change. So I appreciate your taking the time to do this, Jack. And thanks. And thanks for, actually, I want to thank you for publishing some great books.
Thank you.
I've read quite a few of them, and I appreciate what you do. So this has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books, publishing, and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Jack David from ECW Press. And thank you for listening.